Safer? Like, is he a safer box on, or is it all the hell?
I can get it safer, but I think it will move it around if you have to.
Yeah.
Good evening, and welcome to what we call an interactive forum of case studies in halachic predicaments, workplace halachic predicaments. My name is Dr. Charles Snow. I serve as the Dean of the Seistim School of Business, and we're privileged to have this evening Rabbi Mordechai Willig, who is Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. He's also the Rabbi Dr. Saul Roth Professor of Talmud and Contemporary Halacha. Give you a little of the genesis of how we came to put together this interactive forum. About a year ago, it was about 2 hours before Shabbos, and I received a frantic phone call from one of my former students, who was doing his first season in tax, and it was Friday, about 2-3 hours before Shabbos, as he was leaving, his supervisor, who was a woman, said to him, "And I expect that I'll see you on Sunday in the office. We have a lot of tax work to do." And he quickly thought about it and realized that it was just going to be he and his supervisor, the lady, and he was potentially in a problem of yichud. And he went and he called the Rav of his shul and talked about the specifics in terms of the various issues that he had in terms of the office and locks and whatnot. And in discussion with the Rav, it was determined that he did have a problem of yichud, potentially, that Sunday. And the Rav advised him to call one of his former professors or deans to figure out how he's going to wiggle out of the situation. So I got the call 2 hours before Shabbos. And I worked it out with him, some ideas and so forth. But I wasn't surprised that the student thought of the issue of Yichud. And the reason is because he was a graduate of the Seistim School of Business. And within our school, we pride ourselves that we offer our students during their 4 years that they're within the university a quality education both in Judaic and secular studies. And therefore, he certainly had this awareness to realize that there may be some halachic conundrum here that he needs to speak to a rebbe about. Back at the office, we then, as I relayed the story to a number of my colleagues, we then began to say that, you know, if this individual had this particular problem, there are many probably other halachic issues, conundrums that people face on a daily basis that we would probably add some value to various communities if we would raise some of these types of situations and position it within the context of an interactive forum where there are questions that then could be asked related to the various cases that will be discussed. And I assigned, therefore, one of my employees, Josh Ross. Josh is in the back, and Josh, you want to just raise your hand? Anybody, by the way, anybody who needs some of the cases we'll discuss, Josh has copies, just raise your hand, he'll come around. He really just took the ball and ran with it. We worked on the cases, he set up the, orchestrated the various locations. This is the third of three we did a couple of weeks ago in Teaneck. 2 weeks ago we did in the Five Towns in Woodmere, and tonight here on the Upper West Side. The format that will follow is each of you have received a set of cases that we're going to discuss. Each of these cases are actual real live cases that at some point took place. What we did was we obviously played with them somewhat, created a vignette, put some different words in there in each case. Some of the words you'll hear Rabbi Willig talk about why that is a determining factor in a particular direction of potentially the decision, halachic decision that will be rendered. I want to caution you, of course, that in any particular situation that you're in, it's always important to speak to the Rav that you normally speak to on halachic issues, and what you should come away with tonight is not with a final determination of a psak din as much as simply that there are issues here that need to be considered. So the forum is here to raise your awareness and to give you an opportunity to raise questions related to the scenarios so that you can get some better feel as to particular circumstances that might be troublesome. So we'll go through each of the cases, which will take us about 3-4 minutes for Rabbi Willig to respond, and then what we'll do after each response is open it up to the floor. And I would ask that as you want to raise a question, and please feel free to, we had quite lively questions, a number of questions asked both at the Teaneck location and the Woodmere, and I'm sure we'll have this evening as well. Feel free, it's an interactive forum as I mentioned, but please do wait for the microphone which Josh will carry and bring to you so that we can all benefit and hear the question that you've raised, and then we'll be able to obviously give you the response. At some point at the end of each scenario, we're obviously bounded by some time limits, so if we find that we're spending too much time, we just may have to cut questions if need be and go on to the next scenario. There is a email address at the bottom of the sheet on page 2, which is an email address for the SIM school. If you do have any follow-up questions, ideas, thoughts, comments, we more than are happy to receive the thoughts, comments, and if you have certainly questions, we'll forward it to the appropriate rabbinic authorities so that you can get a response. So without any further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce Rabbi Willig.
Thank you very much, Dr. Snow. I would like to begin with an introduction of a general nature, which I believe will inform our later particular discussions of the scenarios found in front of you. Unfortunately, throughout the long diaspora, not everyone has conducted himself or herself in a proper fashion in business relationships. And this is especially true in relationships that we have with people who are not members of Klal Yisrael. Somehow a mistake crept in. People sometimes thought that there is no violation of theft with respect to Nochrim. This is patently untrue. La halacha, according to strict Jewish law, the violation of Geneva and Gezela of theft applies to all, to Jew and non-Jew alike, and therefore one must be very, very careful in these dealings not to make this mistake. I'm saying it up front because people have made this mistake in the past. As a matter of fact, I'd like to begin by reading to you a brief quotation from the Sefer Be'er HaGola, written on the side of the Shulchan Aruch and Choshen Mishpat in Simon Shin Mem Ches, which is entitled Isu Geneva, the violation of stealing. And he writes as follows. Very important quotation. We know that, as I said before, the prohibition applies of stealing, but there are certain circumstances where there is some kind of leniency, and I'll read you what the response of the Be'er HaGol is as follows. Quote, Vani kosev zos lidoros. I'm writing this for all the generations. Shiraisi rabim godlu veheshiru mintos shehitu ha'akom. There are those who became great and wealthy because they fooled non-Jews. Let me explain to you. Fooling a non-Jew is prohibited by Torah law. The Gemara tells them in Masech Tachulin that Geneva's das is prohibited. It's fooling, and even if you're fooling a non-Jew. But there were those who did it and they became apparently very successful and wealthy. V'lo hitzlichu, but ultimately they did not succeed. V'yardu nechseyam letimayo, all of their wealth went down the tubes. V'lo hinichu achareyam barucho, and they did not leave anything for their children ultimately, because their money, their wealth, came to naught. However, I also saw Rabin Asher Kinshu Hashem. So by contrast, there were many who sanctified Hashem's name. V'yachziru tos ha'akum b'davar choshuv. They never fooled anybody. The non-Jew made a mistake. His own mistake. His own mistake tos akum, technically speaking, you may keep, as it's an aveda. We know with respect to Aveda, it says Aveda's Ochicha, the Aveda of your brother, and there is no requirement la halacha to return. We're not going to go in now into the Dina de Machusa, we're talking about an abstract. They get returned in anyway, as in fact is required in order to be Mekad Hashem Shemayim, for Kiddush Hashem. What was the result? They lost so much money. Godlu veheshiru v'itzlichu. Despite the fact they gave away so much money, which they perhaps were entitled to keep, according to strict halacha, they gave it away to Kiddush Hashem. They became great and wealthy and successful. V'inichu Yisrael la'ol aleihem, and they were successful their entire lives. So when they passed on from this world, they left a legacy, a financial legacy for their children. We see that contrary to one's first thought that take whatever you can take and be successful, the Be'er HaGola, who lived in the 17th century, is telling us that that's short-sighted. But the longer view, even from the perspective of enlightened self-interest based on history, the longer view is don't be the beneficiary of ill-gotten gains. Even if, technically speaking, you're permitted to keep the money, if you have an opportunity to be Mekad Hashem Shemayim and return it, you must do so. This is a tremendous lesson for all generations, down to our own generation. You know, in our times, there's so much cross-check in computer records, etc. It's not so easy to find a case where someone makes a mistake in your favor and it will not be ultimately caught. That's what I'm told. There are a lot of checking and cross checking. But it wasn't always that way. Before the advent of the computers, if someone wrote you a check for more money than you deserved, and you kept the money, it was unlikely that anyone would ever find out. Unlikely. Yet, there were always tzaddikim, righteous individuals, who even if they were dealing with nochrim, would give the money back. And even as we saw before, Davar Chashuv, I like to quote the example of a very famous individual, actually I believe lived in this community at one point in time. His name was Irving Bunim, a name that lives on in history of our community as a great Torah leader. In his biography, it is described that he was a textile industrialist, and apparently a client who was not Jewish made a mistake in Mr. Bunim's favor of tens of thousands of dollars then. Then means 60, 70 years ago. I'm not smart enough to extrapolate that into today's dollars. Maybe my computer experts can figure it out. They're talking about hundreds of thousands or maybe a million. I don't know what it's exactly worth in today's dollars. A lot, an inordinate amount of money. He gave it back. And the non-Jewish customer was shocked. Never would have been found, this mistake. And he probably could have found some kind of dispensation that was called Tol Sakam. He said, no, the money's not mine. I want to be Mekadosh Shem Shemayim. I don't want to have any ill-gotten gains, even if it's not a technical violation of Gezel. And he gave the money back with Mekadosh Shem Shemayim. And the bracha, of course, was fulfilled. That he was able to be successful for the remainder of his business career and to help out his children, his grandchildren have prospered almost beyond description, and this is perhaps because of the great self-sacrifice demonstrated by this individual. All of us should aspire to this. That should be said about us, that we are Mekadosh Shem Shemayim. We sanctified God's name by giving back money to non-Jews, which will increase their estimation of what a proper Torah Jew is all about. Unfortunately, I was just told just today in the Beis Medrash that there was a picture of a Jew in Orthodox with an Orthodox appearance on cover page of one of the New York newspapers over the weekend. I don't know exactly what he did wrong. There was a picture of his home, his palatial home, and some slumlord. I don't know even the details. I just someone mentioned to me in the yeshiva today. Better talk about it. I'm here to talk about it. That's what's called a Chilul Hashem. I don't know what he did wrong. I don't know if he did anything wrong. But it's a Chilul Hashem when this image of an Orthodox Jew who was less than exemplary in his business practices is found in the media. Now, it's true that they have their biases and they're trying to catch us. You know, and maybe if he wouldn't have a beard, and if he would not be an Orthodox Jew, he wouldn't have gotten the same press. But that's part of being Orthodox. That's what it's about. We are held up to a higher standard, just as, for example, the state of Israel is held to a higher standard than the other nations because we are supposed to be the Am Hashem, the nation of God. So too, an Orthodox Jew in America is held to a higher standard, and therefore, if you're doing anything in business, what do they call it today? Transparency and accountability. Those are the magic words now. Whatever you're doing, assume it'll be in tomorrow's newspaper. And if it's, therefore, if you're doing it above board, that's fine. If it's not above board, think twice before you do it, because you never know what'll come out. I want to have one final quote before we go to the actual scenarios, which I believe Dr. Snow will introduce, and that is the Maharsha in Masechta Ksuvos. Listen carefully. Also lived around the same time as the Be'er HaGolah. Look what he writes about his generation. Amazing. This is what he says. Quote, the Rabbim B'dor HaZeh, there are many in this generation, Shemekapsim Osher Shalahem, that gather their wealth, Shalo Be'emuna, without faith, Uvechilul Hashem, and they desecrate the name of God. Kigzelas ovei kochovin. They steal from non-Jews, which is theft as well as desecrating God's name. Then they donate. They're big philanthropists. They donate this money for charity. Leos them kavod b'chol shana, so that they should have honor and glory every year. V'laseis lehem birchas misha berach. After all, they gave so much money for tzedakah. Leos them shame and tiferes. They should be considered important members of their community. Concludes the Marsha. V'ein ze ela mitzvah bo ba'aveira. There's a mitzvah which comes to an aveira which doesn't count. One who gives charity just to make himself a name, and it's giving money which is not really properly acquired, it's only a chil, it's a chil Hashem, it will not last, and therefore it's the wrong way to go. Isn't it amazing that in all the years that have passed, so little has changed? That's what I find. We've traversed the Atlantic Ocean from Poland to America. We've now passed over 300 years have passed since then, and things, the more things change, the more they stay the same. There are too many of us who are applying less than optimal standards in our business relationships. This could cause chalila achil Hashem, which is the worst avera, worst sin. By contrast, there are many of us who are exemplary, who are going beyond the letter of the law, and they're what we're doing, perform what we call Kiddush Hashem, giving back money to, especially to a non-Jew, which they might not required, be required to do, technically speaking, to sanctify Hashem's name. This is the ultimately valuable act in this world. One who can sanctify God's name, this is the greatest mitzvah. Just as desecrating God's name is the worst avera. Keep this in mind as a general overview as we approach the scenarios, Dr. Snow.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi Willard. We're going to start with case number one, which everybody has, and again, I'll just paraphrase very briefly what the case says. There are banking laws that state that if you witness another employee that is engaged in some type of illegal activity, that you need to report the activity to the regulatory authorities. Assuming for a moment that you witness another individual engaged in those illegal activities and that individual is a Jew, are you in that case permitted to go to the regulatory authorities? Are you permitted to go to the supervisor? Part of those laws also indicate that if you do not report the incident, then if the individual, the perpetrator, is caught and it's found that you had the prior knowledge, you are as held as culpable as the perpetrator. And of course then the question becomes, are you allowed to go and report on the individual, or does it fall under some law that prohibits you specifically from doing that?
It's important that we distinguish between the two parts of this question. The second part of the question has two things indicating that one in fact should report. Number one, you're reporting to a supervisor. You're not reporting to any regulatory or governmental authority. Reporting to a supervisor, it seems, is a requirement for a simple reason of lo samor al dam reyecha. Do not stand idly by as your neighbor's blood is being lost. And the rabbi interprets not only to save his life, but to save his money as well. This someone is taking money from someone in an illicit fashion, and you who find out about it are required to put a stop to it, if it's at all possible. If you can just, as we say, blow the whistle and put a stop to it, you are required to do so, not merely permitted. You are required. Secondly, of course, the second consideration is that if you don't, you are going to be held responsible, perhaps even ultimately in some governmental or legal system. So of course the what we call the prohibitions of quote mesira do not apply against the two reasons. One, you're speaking to a supervisor, you're not speaking to the government, and number two, you, if you don't say anything, can become in trouble with the law as well. So I think the second case is fairly straightforward. The first case is a bit more complex. The first case says you should report to regulatory authorities, and in some of these cases, we don't find that you're going to be held to a level of responsibility if you do not do so. This is already a much more complicated question. To go to authorities, one has to weigh various considerations. On the one hand, we don't have to go to authorities with respect to the malfeasance of other members of the Jewish community. There's an ancient tradition of mesira being a very serious offense. On the other hand, we're not discussing the types of governments that the Talmud and the earlier authorities are discussing, which were totalitarian, which were brutal and not answerable to anybody. The Talmud teaches us that once you give someone over to the government, it's ketom michmar, they can do with him whatever they want, ultimately even kill him, even though he's not guilty of more than a monetary offense. That was the severity of Mesira. Does Mesira apply today in the United States government? A government which is a Malchus HaChesed, as Moshe Feinstein referred to the United States government, that's a different story. Not everyone agrees that there is Mesira. Rav Moshe held that there is, even though it's a Malchus HaChesed. And before one discounts his opinion, one should do a careful study of what happens in today's prisons. If one, in fact, is incarcerated, it could actually be, believe it or not, in America, a dangerous situation. Frankly, I was a bit shocked when I read an article about this in a recent Jewish journal written by Rabbi Broid, who was a rabbi in Atlanta, and he's also a professor of law, and he did his due diligence to find out the statistics about what happens in the United States prisons, and it's not a happy picture. Really very shocking that this is not communist Russia, it's the United States. Despite that fact, there were all too numerous descriptions of actual danger. That was terrible difficulties that are suffered in jails, not by law, but by the other jailmates, etc. It's not a simple situation. It depends on what kind of facility. But not so simple to say that, well, it's a different kind of a system. It is different, of course, than before, but still, it's not a necessarily a guarantee of safety that the United States government is watching over you. That's a consideration. At the same time, one has to be aware of the fact that there are tshuvas of the great poskim that say if it's your responsibility to report to a government, you must. For Moshe is a tshuva about someone who wants to work for the IRS. May I work for the IRS? After all, what is involved? You know, you're checking people's tax reports. This one's no good, that one's no good, and certainly there are members of B'nai Yisrael whose tax reports are no good. Says Rav Moshe, it's okay. You're allowed to take that job. And if you do the job properly, which means perhaps Reuven will be called into the IRS and be told to, you know, give more money. Well, it's only a matter of more money, that's okay. I'm not an expert in tax law to know how egregious the violation has to be before there are penalties which go beyond money. Certainly we should be well advised not to fall into that category for many reasons, including not only Chilul Hashem, but no one wants to be in that situation. Therefore, again, to summarize, in the second situation in which you reported to a supervisor, and number two, if you don't report, you face the same level of responsibility, that is clearly permissible. In the first case, where you're reporting to a regulatory authority, there is no mention of equal responsibility under the law on your part. That's more complex and must be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. That's my brief answer, and if there are any questions, I'm happy to try to take them, if there are any. Yes, please wait for the mic.
Thank you. I think the question is pretty clear when you see somebody who's doing something that but often, at least from my experience, I've seen things where it just didn't smell right. And the example I'll give you is See, if you go back a couple of years to a lot of the bankruptcies and a lot of the equity research guys were getting in a tremendous amount of trouble for some of the things they were writing and putting out to the marketplace in lieu of a meltdown at some of these companies. And I was happened to be working on one of these companies after the meltdown came about, and we were doing a little bit of backtracking after seeing where the reports were coming out. And it was remarkably clear that there was a lot of parallel between some of the stuff that the guys who got in trouble said and some of the stuff that guys in the fixed income market or the more institutional market where in order to invest you have to be a sophisticated investor, quote unquote. And it was about a day lapse between what the guy that was going to jail was saying and what the other guy was saying. And it just seemed like they were must have been on the same phone call. Something just didn't smell right, and we weren't sure what to say. I mean, the status of the company was already determined, but it just didn't smell right.
Well, if it doesn't smell right, if you experience a bad smell when you're walking somewhere, you walk the other way on the other block. So we don't want to be part of a bad smell. You know, the bad smell can get into us. Into our clothing, into our bodies. We don't want to be tarred with that bad smell. So you have to have a sensitive nose to know what smells bad and walk the other way, even if it's not an absolute illegality. I believe that we should hold ourselves to a higher standard.
But it wasn't that I had an option of walking away or that we had an option of walking away.
Why not?
Because it didn't directly affect us. We were kind of doing background check. We were trying to figure out what happened.
Well, that's after the fact. After the fact is not a question of what to do. You're just making a comment that after the fact you notice.
It's responsible to say, hey, we smelled something bad. How come nobody looked at this before?
Right. That's a very good thing to do. Why does this, something doesn't look right over here? But that's after the fact. So, you prompt me to mention, thank you, that we should not only be worried about illegalities, we should be worried about things that smell bad. I agree. I know it's not a precise term in American law, but I think many of us know what it means. And what do they say? Once a person, I know it when I see it, right? You feel it, you know when you see me. When you see it, when you smell it, walk the other way. Yes, sir?
I just to comment on the question, actually. If the law says that you must report this to an authority, there must be a consequence for not reporting it, or else they say, gee, we'd like you to report it. If there seems to be a sentence missing, that would make the two equivalent, because there has to be a consequence for not reporting it if you must report it.
I tell you the truth, I'm not a lawyer, but I read it, I read like I read a Tosfos, you know. The way I read it, the law states you must do it, but it's like in Jewish law. A lot of things you're supposed to do, and if you don't do it, there's no, there's no legalistic consequence. You know, God pays back for everything we do good and bad, but there are many things in Jewish law which we're supposed to do, but if you don't do it, you're not going to be punished officially in a bedroom. So that's how I read the first sentence. I preface that I'm not a lawyer, but I'm only answering the question as it is found over here, so. I bow to the authority of the lawyers who can tell me that I'm making a mistake and that we have to re-examine it.
To what extent do you have to take further activities if you tell it to the supervisor, but you don't have the impression the supervisor is going to know anything about it? You don't know anything more. Mm-hmm. To what extent are you required to go further?
Again, that requires a lawyer, but my understanding is that if you have a responsibility based on what's the text in front of us, you are responsible to report to a supervisor. That is your responsibility. I believe that once you have fulfilled their responsibility, then it's now the supervisor's responsibility to make a decision as to what to do. He may decide that what you are witnessing perhaps is not really illegal, or perhaps it doesn't rise to the level that he's required to blow the whistle. That's his responsibility, you know, in life. As you move up, there are greater levels of responsibility, and we'll call them the lower individual who discharges his responsibility by speaking to a supervisor, I believe is absolved of any further responsibility. I would say that if you feel that the supervisor is either illegally or immorally suppressing information which you gave, perhaps there's an opportunity that you have, or maybe must take advantage of, to go over his head to his supervisor. But that obviously requires, again, a case-by-case analysis, because otherwise the whole world is going to fall apart. Everyone's jumping over their supervisor to the next supervisor. Obviously there's a system put in place which is supposed to work. But perhaps it's written in the books, what do you do when the supervisor is just dropping the ball? So, but that requires, that's beyond the actual text in front of us.
What did you mean by walk the other way? Walk the other way.
You, slowly. You're going back to a question before.
It wasn't clear. If you smell something bad, walk the other way.
You should not be involved in such an activity.
Don't get involved.
I think that's what I meant when I answered the question.
Just a clarification. It says that, again, this is more of a technical question. It says you have to witness the employee. Does it mean you are absolutely sure that the employee, again, it's similar to the question that was asked before.
Same preface. I'm not an attorney. I'm reading what it says here. The word witness means you witness it. You see it with your own eyes, not hearsay evidence, not surmising. The word in front of me is witness. You see someone is doing something illegal. That's what the plain text says. There's no room for doubt. You witness, I mean, unless you made a mistake. In your mind, there's no doubt. You witness something, someone's doing something illegal. That's the question at hand.
I just think about the whistleblower message again. We phrased another interesting wrinkle aside in here. If you blow the whistle on someone who's, some company that has a government contract, if you do that and it's prosecuted, you get a reward for that. You get like twice or three times the penalty of it. So that if you do get that, should you keep it or give it to the doctor or whatever?
I'm not the first I hear about a reward for whistleblowing, which the truth to tell is not so simple in halacha. If you get a reward for whistleblowing, are you kosher liedus? Is this included? You know, someone says in the Gemara, someone takes money for testifying, we begin to wonder about his credibility. I can imagine that if they're giving you money for whistleblowing, of course the answer in the government talks, they're not believing you. You're just what we call in our language a maramakam. You're just pointing to the fact, and then they will do an independent investigation to prove guilt. So they don't need your credibility. You're just literally a whistleblower. But from the perspective of halacha, you know, witnesses that are being paid to say what they say, that's an interesting question. So I don't know. Yes, sir.
I think the idea of the reward is more intended as something to offset the penalties that occur to the whistleblower, in the sense that he may well be penalized, but as has happened many times, they lose their job, they lose all kinds of societal approval, so they need this not so much as a reward but as a way of surviving their courage of being whistleblowers in the first place.
In other words, what it's been now described to me is you're not being paid just to offset the expected loss from whistleblowing. Well, that's okay.
Both aspects are in there. You can get multi-million-dollar reward. Essentially, if you essentially become a civilian prosecutor, district attorney, I forgot what it's called, the exact term for it, but you prosecutors, I'm instead of the government, and essentially you can get like five times the penalty of it, and part of it is clearly to make up for that, also part of it is the reward for it. Both aspects are there.
Okay, good to know. Since in my business of teaching Gemara, we very rarely blow whistles on a Rebbe who gives a wrong shot in a toast or something. No one's giving us any rewards for that. So.
One more question. If the evidence against the person who you're avoiding is circumstantial, are you allowed to report?
Offhand, no. And from a halakhic perspective, we say, I mentioned it before, witness means you witness something which is quite clear. Now, if it's circumstantial, you may be wrong. You may be just maybe completely wrong. You're putting two and two together and getting five. That happens frequently. Of course, I'm not sure what the law of the state is. Banking law state, you witness an illegal act. Doesn't sound circumstantial. The simple reader, this is witnessing in a plain sense. I think we're up to the next scenario.
Okay, on the next one, we'll call it our buyer beware scenario. You're a financial planner. What you do is you sell complex financial instruments and plans to clients, and you have an elderly couple who you have spent quite an amount of time describing both the risks and the rewards of that particular complex financial instrument. And as you describe to them the risks and the rewards, you clearly see that they understand the rewards, but they do not grasp fully what the risks are. And you can see sort of a glazed view. You're very upfront with them in terms of what the risks are, that they can lose a sizable amount of money. But somehow or another, they just are focused on the reward part. They don't seem to understand the risk part. And you sort of sense that as you explain it to them. And the question is, you obviously want to make the sale because you work on a commission basis, but the fact that they have not grasped potential risk to them, the question is halakhically, what are you allowed to do in this particular case?
This question divides into two. If you feel that the risk that you're describing to these individuals, which they don't grasp, makes this an ill-advised investment on their part, you are not permitted to make the sale. That's called an Eitza She'ena Hogenes. It's in a sense bad advice, and it would be a violation of the Torah prohibition of Lifnei Evil or Sita and Michal, one who puts a stumbling block in the way of someone who literally doesn't see. These people don't see. You know why they don't see? Ki Ashochad Ya'aver Enei Chachamim. That a bribe makes someone blind. They're literally as if they either. They just see the they see all the rewards, and that blinds them to the risks. So if you feel that this risk is given their age bracket, their financial situation, is not a worthwhile one, is you are absolutely prohibited from making the sale. The only time there is a question is if you think that really it's a good idea for them to enter into this situation, despite the risks that exist. After all, you know, in life there are always risks. But do you feel that, for example, if you were in that situation, or if your parents were in that situation, you would recommend this financial instrument, despite the risks? But to be upfront, you tell them, listen, there are these risks. They don't understand it. That's the question. Can you make that kind of a sale? In other words, if you wouldn't have bought it on your own, in that circumstance, there's no way you can make that sale. It's not right. You certainly wouldn't be required to tell them, if I were you, I wouldn't buy it. Now, if they want to buy it anyway, then perhaps you'd be able to make the sale on the grounds. Look, they're throwing their money away. You tell them, don't do it. But in the case in which you really would buy it, but you would buy it with your eyes open, knowing the risks. They're buying with their eyes closed, not really knowing the risks. Can you engage in that kind of a situation? I was told there are specific laws in the books about these kinds of things. Informed consent. You have to at least think that they know what they're getting themselves into. If you realize they don't, American law prohibits your selling it to them. Even though, if we're your own parents, you'd buy it for them. I think it's a good idea for them, but they have to be able to know. And it's not enough that you describe it. You have to at least, honestly, be able to say that you thought they understood the risks. And of course, I believe it should maintain this higher standard of New York State, and therefore we would not make that sale in any of these circumstances. I'll open the floor now for questions.
This is very much apply to any person in sales in general, because you have a product, you're very familiar with the competitor's products, you're familiar with your product, you know the weaknesses of the product that you're selling. Are you obligated to talk about that? Are you obligated to tell people that you work on a commission and that, you know, just so you know, if you don't get it, I don't make my commission. I mean, there's so much you could divulge. And in sales, you have to, I understand how luckily you can say, okay, just talk about the positives, but how much are you really obligated to say?
Okay.
And also, in the case of the financial planner, what if he's just not 100% sure?
Mm-hmm. Let me try to answer. As far as that you're on a commission basis, I don't believe in the need to divulge. I think it's self-explanatory. Everyone understands the person is selling you something. You're not paying them a salary. So it seems that it's sort of assumed that it's a commission basis. Perhaps there are certain companies that pay their workers fixed rates no matter what they do, but I think I believe it's the exception rather than the rule.
Financial planning is very complex, though. People don't know where they get the commission, upfront, back end, you know.
Leave that upfront, back end, but obviously, if it's a commission basis, you have a stake in there buying the plan or the whatever else you'd be selling, furniture, whatever you're selling. I believe that yes, there is a disclosure obligation by halacha. If somehow you feel that your product is flawed, I mean, as sad as it sounds, you got to say so. There's this famous story of one of the great Gedolim had a field he wanted to sell, and he was unsuccessful. And the reason is, whenever a potential customer would come and tell him, you should know, it's not such a good field. It doesn't grow so well, and there are too many rocks there. And we'd come up every time with new chesroimus, with new shortcomings of this field. So no one wanted to buy it. The kind of tzaddik he was, that he wanted a full disclosure of every failing. Now, the truth is that's proper behavior. If you're selling a car and you know that your car is inferior, so you really, strictly speaking, should be telling the customer, you know, this car is a very good car and it looks very nice, and it has a very good stereo system, but the brakes are a problem. You know, so you have to be upfront about shortcomings that you know about. If you don't know, you don't know. No one knows everything. But to fool people is not appropriate. You have to really be as upfront as possible.
My question was really the gray area. That was really the question.
Well, gray areas are by definition gray. But I can't.
My point was, you know it so well that you could theoretically, if you were a buyer, you could find reasons to say there's always pros and cons to both sides. Are you required to give them all the pros and all the cons, even though they're both good products?
Offhand, the default position in that question is yes, you're required to divulge whatever you know. I can understand what you call the gray areas. There's a limit to what you can describe. There's such a minutiae sometimes that the average person wouldn't understand if you describe it to them. That's the nature of things. Someone in a particular area of business or sales knows more about it than the typical consumer, but to hide shortcomings is just not proper.
Would you say that you're stealing from your own company by being extra honest?
Stealing from your own company, being honest?
Yeah.
How could you say so?
You have an obligation to, if you're
to be
boss,
dishonest. You have an obligation to be dishonest.
Not to be dishonest.
But
if you're
less than honest.
Your boss tells you sell the positives. I'm not telling you to, like, you know,
you tell your boss, listen, I'll do sales, but I'm going to do sales according to what my standard of ethical, which for us means halakha behavior, requires. And that means to be as upfront as possible. If you're a salesperson and you don't believe in your product, that's not good. You really shouldn't be in that. You have to believe in your product. You think it's a very good product. That could mean that there's some other product that it has certain pluses over yours, but yours has other pluses over that. But again, if it's something which the person who gets done is going to understand, I would be upfront. But some of this is so nuanced and so it's such small details that you won't understand anyway. So if that's the case, if you feel that your product is a very good product, you can sell the product. You don't have to go into details which you won't understand at all. But that's again case by case. Are there any other questions about this scenario? Yes.
I face this problem regularly. I'm a stockbroker. I face a slightly, you alluded to it, the problem of a client who wants to take a greater risk than I think is wise for them to take.
Mm-hmm.
And the question of when to refuse to put the order in for the client and when to consent to put the order in for the client. There are times when the client says, it's my money and I can do whatever I want, and I will respond to them, you can, but you can't do it for me. You can take the money and do it wherever you want to do it, but you can't do it for me. There are other times when I feel, to a certain extent, that I'm reducing his risk, because if he went someplace else, he would take even greater risk than I'm allowing him to do. So in some cases, I will allow him to take some risk and not others. And in certain circumstances, I'm thinking to myself that although this is not a proper risk, it's not that bad. But trying to reach in my own mind a decision on these things is not easy. And if you can give me some criteria or other things that can help me as to when I should absolutely refuse to do it for the person and when I should allow them to do something that I think they're doing which is improper for them to do, that would be helpful for me.
Oh, I'd love to be able to give you these precise guidelines. You said very well that a person can, in fact, do with his money what he wants. He can take all of his money and go to Atlantic City, right? Or buy lottery tickets. You know, people do all kinds of things. What is it? Hey, you never know. But statistically, I believe that's probably worse than almost any stock market investment. But people do what they want. We can't stop them. We say in America, it's a free country. Nonetheless, for our professional reputations as well as for our conscience, we should not be participants, silent participants. In unwise investments, we deem unwise. We're supposed to give advice, which is good. Now, you're right, there are those who come back and say, listen, it's my money. I have this dream of striking it rich. You're telling me that it's probably a pipe dream. I'm going to lose all my money. If I were you, I would not make that sale. Because if you think the likelihood is going to lose all his money, so at the end of the day, it's not going to be good for you or good for him, and it's just better just not being involved. If he buys it through someone else, so be it. On the other hand, as you said so correctly, if by involving yourself with this individual, you are ultimately minimizing the risks, because on his own, who knows what he'll do? Then you're doing a mitzvah. And even though the risk that he's taking is a greater one than you would deem appropriate, but since what he would do otherwise is even a greater risk, you're doing him a favor. So I believe that the criterion that you have devised is a very appropriate one, although, as I say, in every case, there are nuances and details which have to be analyzed separately.
What about the scenario where you are you're not the person involved in the sale, but you know some information about the stock, and someone comes to you and asks you the question, but under law, you're not allowed to divulge that because you have some sort of inside information, because if you're an auditor or you're somehow otherwise involved in the company. What happens when some independent person comes to you and says to you, you know, I'm thinking of investing in this stock, and just says that to you? And, you know, obviously, whether asking your opinion or not, on the one hand, you know that the stock is going to tumble the next day. But on the other hand, you have and it's a bad investment for them, but on the other hand, you have an obligation of saying, of not being allowed to disclose this by law. Where does that put you?
Look, that's very simple. If you're not allowed to disclose the insider information by law, you should not disclose that information, because that's open and shut. However, one has to look carefully at the law. One may say, you know, not based on insider information, I'm going to buy such and such a stock. And you say, listen, I don't know. I mean, I'm not so sure it's such a good investment. I don't know if the law prevents it from saying that. My guess is if you don't reveal your insider information, you're just saying it's not a good idea, bad idea. There could be 1,000 reasons why it's good or bad. And in fact, he probably won't listen to you when you say it's a bad idea if you don't tell him why and how you know it, you know, on authority, on insider information. So again, depending on what a lawyer says, it seems to me that my read of common sense law is that although giving the insider information may be prohibited by state law, just saying, you know, think twice about it shouldn't be prohibited. But if even that's prohibited, then you got to follow the law. Any other questions on this one? Let's move to the next one.
Next question is one that we find in today's society, certainly with the advent of computers and the internet. You have an employee who meets the minimum objectives that you set, the goals that you set in terms of work during the course of a day. However, that employee will soon get the work done in quicker time than maybe the day, the 8 hours in a day, and the rest of the time the employee is surfing the web. And you know, you'd like that, certainly you'd love to get more work out of the employee if you knew that. And the question is, are you allowed to ask MIS to monitor the employee's internet use and report back to you on that employee's use?
This question gives me an opportunity to make, again, a general introduction. The Chafetz Chaim writes that whenever there is a contract between one party and another, the most important rule is to be up front. The more that it's made explicit, the smaller the chance for subsequent recriminations and disputes. I believe that if an employee joins a particular company, especially if everyone has a computer these days and can be surfing the web continuously, that's a possibility, tell him up front that you are going to make random checks on his computer to see what sites he visited and what kind of emails he's getting and sending. But be up front. Tell him. This is not a private organization, so it's a company. What you're doing is not something which is going to be held kept private. Anything you do with on this computer, which belongs to the company, is going to be checked randomly from time to time. You have a girlfriend, so I recommend that you talk to her in some other medium, not on the computer of the company, because we're going to be, you know, looking over you. You tell them up front, this not only it should eliminate recrimination, but also any possibility of what we call the cheirim d'rabbeinu gershon, not to open someone else's mail. What about email? You know, is that included? Perhaps yes, perhaps no. But if you're up front and tell them, listen, my email on my computer is going to be checked from time to time. I want to know what you're talking about, to whom you're talking, what are you doing? If it's up front, it's permissible. That's, I believe, the proper response. I'm told that there are companies who do this. They up front, they say, we're going to, every one in every 10 emails at random, we're going to check. So you better be aware of the fact that some things that are going to be found out, and therefore, of course, you're going to ask the MIS to monitor the employee's internet use, since you told them about it in the first place. That's, I think, the recommended procedure here. Yes?
If you have reason to believe that the company you're working for has not notified people of their employees of any such, you know, random check, and your request to assist your supervisor or whoever it is with such a check against a different employee, is there any issue there?
There is an issue, but the issue is easily solved. You tell your supervisor, listen, please make this upfront statement. Say, you know, I feel uncomfortable this way. Just be upfront and say, we're going to be making checks randomly of your email, of your internet, whatever these technical terms mean. And therefore, beware, this is something which you shouldn't be doing. It seems to me it's such a clear and obvious suggestion. Why would you do it that way? There are companies who are doing it that way, so why shouldn't your company be one of them? Let it be a leader. Well, you did a big mitzvah. You did a big mitzvah. Here's a person who, in effect, was stealing from his company. He's using the company's computer and phone to run his own business. I consider that to be theft. You put a stop to the theft. So you did a mitzvah. Right? You might have otherwise found some innocuous surfing of the web, which is not a criminal activity of theft, just, you know, whatever it may be. It would have been a little more uncomfortable, perhaps. So that's why it's always good to be armed with that forewarning that you're going to be doing it.
So there's no issue of having warned the guy, though, that we were going to be checking on him?
I don't believe you have to warn in such a situation, but it's better to warn. You know, why have someone steal and then catch him? Warn him in the first place, he won't steal. He could have still had his job. I'm sorry?
He just would have been more careful.
Oh, he would have stolen anyway.
Probably.
Well,
the element of surprise.
It's understood if you have a job that has a computer or some connection to the internet, there's obviously some MIS that's going to keep track of what you are doing.
Why is it so obvious?
It's just how it works.
The companies have a policy. That's what I said. Have a policy. That's exactly what I recommended. Have a policy. What? No, don't say can. Just tell everyone in advance. That's the company's policy. You don't want it, don't work here. This is our policy. Be upfront. In general, in business matters, be upfront. This solves a lot of the later problems.
Kind of related question. Many companies have very strict policies regarding personal use of anything. Like, you know, the theory of knowledge is anything. Of course, the company, you know, that's not the work environment really that goes on. And companies, you know,
I believe that we have to use the what we call the reasonable guidelines. In other words, if a company will say you can't use the phone for anything, so that means if a person has to call his wife in the middle of the day and he can't use the company phone, so it's, you know, I'm not sure what goes on with personal cell phones, but let's say there's no cell phone service in that building, whatever, has to go downstairs, go out to the building to use his cell phone. So he's wasting much more of company time than it costs the nickel to call his wife from his desk. So everyone understands, despite the rigorous official rules in the company handbook, it's not meant to be kept. It's counterproductive to the company if it's kept in such a rigorous fashion. So I believe this is not the Aseret HaDibros. It has to be interpreted in context with using the what's reasonable as the guideline, and I wouldn't lose sleep over that guy who called his wife from the company phone rather than waste more company time, go downstairs and call. A person that has situations like child is sick, you have to call. I mean, it's not frivolous. Your life goes on even when you go into the company. No one's putting you in a box for 8 hours and say you forget about your family. That would probably be inappropriate even from a company's perspective. You have to be, you know, you don't want to frivolously waste away your time. But there are situations when your personal needs, within reason, I believe, are probably what the company means, but they make it draconian so that when you discount it a little bit, it'll end up with that result. I believe that's what they have in mind.
I think usually they make it so strict that if it comes to a case, they can't, you know, the person can't say, oh, well, you know, it's not great. They can only just say, well, you broke the law, this is the rule, it's a very strict rule. But, like, you know, the company... I mean, what does it mean? Is what your bosses and your supervisors care about? Like, what makes, you know, what is it?
Well, yeah, I think that's exactly true. And there are, you know, many rules that are written, not because they are expected to be followed as written, but it's expected to veer a little bit from there. So if you write it in a more liberal way, it'll veer from there. That's how I understand some of these very strict rules, which are almost impossible to keep. Unfortunately, there's a lot of improper activity on the part of employees that are just goofing off with the web or other such things. So the companies they write the law at the other extreme, and if it's reasonable, I believe the companies wouldn't really mind. We'll go to the next situation.
Just to move us along so we can get out on a timely basis. Here you've just hired, in this next case 3B, a programmer who worked for the competition, and obviously having worked for the competition knows the strengths and weaknesses of the competitors' products. And the question is, now you have this employee working for you, you obviously want to take advantage of this employee's intimate knowledge of the product that he worked on at your competitor. What are you allowed to take out from this particular employee? What are you allowed to ask him about his intellectual property knowledge? And two, if you're the employee, what are you allowed to divulge to your new employer?
Once again, an introduction. There are, see, these scenarios, they're all good because they give you opportunities to develop guiding principles. There are laws, both halachas and secular laws, and there are also contracts or separate agreements made between parties. In many situations, we have these no-compete clauses. No-compete clause either upon employment or in the context of a settlement when an individual is leaving a particular company. Any no-compete clause that you sign is binding upon you. It goes without saying, even though there are those who violate them in the breach. But if you agree to your word, it's binding upon you. Therefore, I'm answering these questions, 3b, in the absence of any no-compete clause signed by the party. And therefore, we're going to address a strict halachic regulation. And I believe it's probably going to dovetail with the state laws, which is what a person knows, he knows. You know, we don't believe in owning. If you're an employee, you're not owned by anybody. As long as you're working for that firm, you're working for them. And if you leave that firm, you're not working for somebody else. Whatever's in your brain is in your brain. They don't have a lock on your brain. And therefore, if another company hires you and asks you certain information, what they call intellectual property, generally speaking, intellectual property is not a halachic term. Property means assets. You own a chair, you own a table. That you own someone's intelligence or knowledge, there's no such thing. The only way that you can prevent the sharing of this quote-unquote intellectual property is by a separate agreement that a person agrees not to divulge. And if you have an employee and you know what he knows and you're afraid that he's going to divulge it to another company, so you do what you can to keep the employee. You know, in communist Russia, the scientists weren't allowed out of the country because they knew too many nuclear secrets. If they tried to leave, they would kill him. I'm not justifying what they did, but they was trying to safeguard the information in that fashion. Since we come from a different society, Baruch Hashem, we don't do that. But if there's a particular employee who has valuable information in his brain and you didn't sign a no-compete clause upon employment, so you know that if he leaves to another company, he can tell them whatever he wants, well, offer him a higher salary to stay. That's all. You can't stay. Offer him a greater severance package with a no-compete clause. Do what you have to do to protect what you call the intellectual property that he has. But if you fail to do that, then on his own, there's no law against it. I don't believe there's a law. There's no-compete contract. I believe that, number one, you can ask him, and number two, he can answer to the best of his knowledge. That's my take. Again, it's not a complete answer because if there are certain agreements, these agreements are controlled. Yes?
Well, I understand what you're saying, that intellectual assets per se don't have any value halachically.
Not no value. A lot of tremendous value, but you can't own them as such. That's what I meant.
But there are other halachos that involve using speech that cause damage for somebody. How come it doesn't fall under that purview?
Very good question. The question is, I work for company A. Now I work for company B. If I help company B, company A sales will go down. I'm causing them damage. Well, you don't have to be a red-blooded American capitalist to know that there could be two companies. So whenever I'm helping company B, company A will suffer. Even if I never worked for company A.
It's because of your knowledge of company B that has the adverse effect. It's because you...
So therefore what?
Because you know the weakness of another company because you work there.
So what?
You're just some outside analyst who just figures it out on his own.
What's the difference? If I'm an outsider and I'm helping company B, company A will suffer. If company A is smart, they'll hire me away. That happens every day of the week. They hire away the best guys. You can now help company A, and that's going to hurt B. And they, a guy who's smart can keep getting a bidding war. Go from A to B to B to A. You know, there are people who do that. So there's nothing halachically wrong with that. You're not really causing them what we call damage. We call it in Jewish terms, in halakhic terms, minias harevach. They're not going to make so much profit next year because you are now working for the competition. I mean, can we give a sports analogy? They have a player leaves the Yankees to go play for the Red Sox, so they win the World Series. They cause damage to the Yankees. What do you do? All right, so they hired, they paid him more money. See, what? You have to be careful with these rules. Again, minag mevatel halacha. That is a statement in the Yerushalmi, which is if there is a particular custom in a particular community, that overrides the laws in the books. My understanding of America is that if there's no compete, that the minig in our society is the person can do with whatever he feels for his present employer. If there's a no compete, again I say it has to be followed. Are there any other questions on this particular scenario? Okay, let's go to the next.
Final case. You are working for a company and you've just been downsized. You've been given some 2 months remaining. In any case, what you've just done before your notice of downsizing, you had just negotiated on the behalf of your employer with a friend who's going to bring his or her business to your company. And the reason they're bringing the business to your company was they had full expectation that you would service their account. And now you've been given the notice that you are going to be downsized. Are you allowed now to go back to that friend of yours who's allegedly going to be bringing the business only because they expected you would be servicing? Are you allowed to go back to them and say, I'm no longer going to be with the firm, I've just been downsized, even though they may now take their business elsewhere?
In what's now becoming a pattern, it seems to me that when the question says, may I have the habit of saying that you must, not just that you may. I think it's the third time tonight. It seems to me that if given this circumstance, that the reason the person is buying from the company is because they expect you to provide them with services, if those are in fact the expectations. And you know now what they don't know. You know you're going to be gone in 2 months. They don't know that. That's Geneva Zas. That's you're being duplicitous. You're fooling the potential clients. They're buying it because they expect you to be there. Now, even if you expect to be there, you can get a pink slip at any moment. That can happen. But at least there was full disclosure at the moment of the agreement. But if you know in advance now what they don't know, that you're going to be gone in 2 months, how can you do that sale? I don't understand. That seems to be wrong according to halacha. I think you must tell them, you know, you want to buy that. I'm working here for 2 more months. I'm representing my company in good faith, and I still think the product is a good product. But I'm telling you one thing: come January 1st, I'm not here anymore. You want to buy it? Buy it. No problem. They may go elsewhere. Then go elsewhere. I think it's also no problem. The problem may arise if they want to come to you. You're working from company A, and you're going to move into company B. So if they want to do company A anyway, fine. They want to go to company C, also fine. No, we want to come with you. Is that considered somehow taking your clients with you? What halakhic status does that have? Well, once again, I believe it depends upon what's understood in that particular community. Strictly speaking, if you move from company A to B, especially since you've been downsized, you didn't leave, they basically kick you out. So they send you away. So they ask you to understand that any personal friends that you have will be very likely more loyal to you than loyal to the company and will go with you. That seems to be a natural understanding. Again, in the absence of no compete clauses and understandings and agreements, which would lead to a different result. But this is how I feel. Not only may you, but I believe you must notify. Yes. Okay, what prevents you in a world of no agreements and no understandings? Nothing prevents you. However, there may be certain what we'll call minhagim customs which would prevent you. However, I repeat, that's only with respect to past clients. But someone who's coming to you now and wants to buy from you now with the expectation you're going to continue to be there—that's a whole different story. I don't see how you can, in good faith, proceed with that sale. Past tense is a different story. Yes?
Let's say somebody's working for a seven, and they're going to go and work for a different seven. And they know that the person who's dealing with them and giving money to the seven is doing it because they're dealing with them personally. But but they think it's a worthwhile cause anyway. But they know if they tell this person, I'm moving to this other charity, this person, the person will then not give any money because they don't want to deal with them personally.
Same thing. All tzedakos are good. I'm assuming every tzedakah here is honest. First I'm working for a hospital, then I'm moving to work for a shul, then I'm going to work for a yeshiva. All things are good. Now, charity dollars, you know, you can do it with it, whatever you want. You give 10% to charity. You can pick the charity of your choice. So you may pick the charity of your choice based upon a particular middleman with whom you have faith or trust or whatever, family relationship, whatever it may be. So there's nothing wrong with that. But again, if there's a particular custom which prevents this fundraiser from engaging in any of these practices, he has to follow that minig or that understanding. Are any more questions? Yes.
Does it make a difference if you know you're leaving behind the account with someone, you know, as capable or even more capable than yourself? Does that make any difference?
Well, again, if let's take this example, case 3C. The point is not whether someone else is capable. The point is that the client wants to deal with you. You may be less capable than somebody else, but you know how it is in personal connections. Business is a lot of who you know, right? They want to deal with you. So it's irrelevant that someone capable is to be left behind. To the contrary, if there's no one capable left behind, that even increases your obligation to say you're leaving. But I say, even if there is someone capable behind, if the person wants to deal with you, you should say both things. I'm leaving. Is someone capable behind? Let them make their own decisions based on the full facts. Yes?
Rabbi, may I come full circle with what you began?
Sure.
And that is the proposition that many of us are exposed to Hilul Hashem by how some groups react in business and the legal field. And what you say is accurate. Some of us who live in those worlds are familiar with certain groups that actually teach the notion that Ken Goblin from I wonder if you're familiar with what rationale do they use for that kind of value system. I mean, I've heard the notion that the Yahafa or Yahafa Kamoka does not apply to the Nukri, and they use that sometimes as source. So I wonder from your point of view, what have you heard to be the arguments made to have two standards? One, how we treat people from our own community, and how we treat people from different communities.
That's a very good question. I'll try to be as clear as I can to answer your question. It is true. I don't want to. We are not permitted to falsify the Torah. The Torah has many laws which are limited to what we'll call the club, the people of Bnei Yisrael. And any of these three words that are used are usually considered to be restrictive. Ochicha, as I mentioned before, in the context of Hashem HaSaveda, or Reacha, as you say, Achla Reacha Kamocha, or Amisecha, literally your colleague. Generally speaking, the Talmud understands these to be restrictive to members of Bnei Yisrael. Notwithstanding that, as we mentioned earlier, the proscription of theft of Losignov applies to non-Jews as well, for one of two reasons. Either as some would have it, because lo sigzol, there's no word achicha. It says lo sigzol, period. Lo tignovu, period, with nesnachta. Or, if you'll say that the words re'acha or achicha find a proximity to the terms lo sigzol, apply to those terms, and therefore one would have thought that Jews are, only applies to Jewish people. There are what we call ribuyim, extra additional psukim found in the Baba Kama of Kuf Yud Gimel, which include specifically the violation, the prohibition of theft from non-Jews. So there is no one, I don't believe there's anyone, any legitimate halakhic authority today who's going to tell you that stealing from non-Jews is permissible. I do not believe there's anyone who's going to say it's against accepted normative halakha. Not to say you won't find a Rishon somewhere who's going to give a different psak as an achlokas in the Gemara, but normatively it's assumed that stealing from non-Jews is absolutely prohibited. With respect to what we call hafkoas halva oso, which means not paying back a debt to such an individual, that's a different story. The Rambam is strict. The Rambam understands that the issue of lo sasho, which means don't hold back money which you owe to someone, applies to non-Jews as well as Jews. The simple, plain reading of Bava Kama Kufi Gimel is not that way. That there is no prohibition. It somehow relates more to the Hashavas Aveda construct, which where the word Achicha is found. Right? Lo Sashok Esreacha V'lo Sigzol. Lo Sigzol is no Reacha, applies to everybody. But Lo Sashok Esreacha, the word Reacha is limiting. So that's different than the case where of out and out theft. The unfortunate reality is that the case that you're describing are not merely where someone is not returning or not paying, which could be perhaps justified if it would not lead to a Chilul Hashem. We said before, Kiddush Hashem is mandatory, even Hashavas Aveda, as it says in the Yerushalmi. Even Hashavas Aveda with its explicit miut, achicha, and not a non-Jew, nonetheless, if it's the Kiddush Hashem, one should, and in fact, one may argue, one must, return it to fulfill the Kiddush Hashem. But the unfortunate reality is that those who are doing things wrong are going all the way. And not just a matter of not giving back lost objects, but they're going to the other extreme and even taking. We saw that in our original quotation. He said, go back to the beginning. These are the two extremes. There were those who fooled the non-Jew, which is illegal. The name of stats of a guy is prohibited. And the good guys, they gave back money which was given to them because not of their own making. The guy made a mistake on his own. Notice, isn't it interesting? The Baragola described two extremes. You know, it didn't describe the average individual who might say, look, I'll do what I have to do, and not more than that. Because apparently in the world in which we live, either you yes or no. And that's why it's so important that we focus on honesty in business, because those who are trying to just toe the line and not step over it very often are going to step over it. And therefore we recommend with respect to these types of transactions to go the other extreme and not only not take what you shouldn't be taking, but even return what perhaps you wouldn't be required to return, technically speaking, in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. To go back to your particular question, yes, there are those who may legitimately draw certain distinctions between Jews and non-Jews. We don't want to falsify. There are certain distinctions with respect to certain of the prohibitions, the Hashavas Aveda and the like. But as I repeat again, normative halacha is clear. You may not steal money from a non-Jew. You may not fool a non-Jew. I don't know of any responsible rabbi or community that would say otherwise.
I would have thought that I've heard in the, although I love what you're saying, I've heard in the Mechirat Chametz, I've heard a great line of rabbis who disagree on that issue.
Mechirat Chametz?
Mechirat Chametz. Does the store that's selling the Chametz have to be closed? Or can it remain open and continue to sell the chametz anyway? And I understood that there were psaks that it's okay for a store to sell its chametz and then continue to sell the loaf of bread or the emptiness cake.
Okay.
Because it's only the name of Akum.
No, I don't believe, I haven't seen that. What I've seen is that if the store is sold, sells its chametz to the non-Jew and it continues to be open for business, that post facto, there is no violation of Hilchos Chametz. So if you want to buy the Chametz in the store after Pesach, you may. I read that response. I did not see anywhere there that the Jew who had sold the Chametz to the non-Jew and who is now selling it business as usual without the permission of the non-Jew, that he's doing right to the law from monetary law. I didn't see that. I believe you're probably referring to the Chametz perspective. That's a different story. You know, we have to draw that important line. We'll take maybe one more question before we break.
So
maybe two.
For a company for a long time, and you have a trade secret, and you go to another company, I just don't understand why that is not Geneva Stas.
No Geneva Stas. You're telling the first company that's letting you go that I'm going to go tell the secret, and it's now going to be done up front. I'm leaving. I worked there for 10 years. I have a trade secret. I'm now going to move to company B. It's offering me a $50,000 raise. And of course, whatever I know, I know.
Is there implied understanding that you've been working for a company for a long
Again, I'm not speaking in the case of implied understandings. If there are implied understandings, you have to abide by them. But I'm discussing in the absence of any custom or implied understandings. So whatever, you and I are on the same page. The young lady had her hand up, I'm sorry. This will be the last question because we want to end what we call on time. You know, I'll tell you about commissions. If it's legitimate, you're entitled to your commission. If it's not legitimate, you should forego the deal and forego the commission. Now, it's true, it's easy for me to say, in my business, we don't work on commission. In other words, if I get a good shear, I don't get an extra bonus, and I hope I don't get too many bad shear. But if I do, I'm not penalized. But we are not permitted to bend the law, stretch the law, certainly not to do things which are wrong just to get a big commission. That, of course, increases what we call in our language the nisayon, the test. It's a greater test for us to do the right thing when by doing so we're foregoing financial gain. No doubt about it. When a God looks down from heaven and sees how we're giving up significant sums of money in order to sanctify his name and to do what's right, we know that we're going to ultimately get a much greater reward. And as we started in our very introductory comment, the greater rewards not only in the next world, but even in this one. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and again, there's an email address if you'd like to send us some comments. Thank you.
So, I appreciate what you said. It's really very meaningful.